Welcome to the March Diner Show. We've got a great hour ahead of us. First, we'll be joined by the first African-American woman ever elected to Congress from Maryland. That's Donna Edwards. She's serving District 4 after winning the spot in a special election when the former Congressman, Albert Wynn, decided to quit after she beat him in the primary. And we'll speak with Congressman Edwards about her vision for America, her agenda in Washington, and her thoughts on some of those pressing issues facing us today. And then ExxonMobil posted record profits in the last quarter, while at the same time we're paying record high prices at the pump and for our home heating oil. Is this price gouging? Should government intervene? Or is hands-off the best way to go? We'll discuss oil, the power of Wall Street, and where this whole economy is going. So join us for your thoughts and questions right after this NPR news break. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Today we have a very interesting show lined up for you. We're going to talk in this first part of our program with Maryland's newest congressional representative. She's also the first African-American woman from the state of Maryland to be elected to the United States Congress. She beat incumbent Albert Wynn in the primary, and he stepped down rather than serving out his term, and she was chosen to fill that seat until until the general election takes place in November. She's a longtime community activist who co-founded the National Network to End Domestic Violence, and she was executive director of the ARCA Foundation, a grant-making institution that supports programs of social equality and justice. And our number here is 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, or you can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And Donna, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And good to talk to you again, and congratulations on being our newest congressional representative.
Thank you. I think the last time we spoke, I was just trying to get there.
That's exactly right. So I just for our listeners, and we have listeners coming in to us today from everywhere, from Prince George's County to Baltimore, from the D.C. suburbs up to Columbia and Annapolis, and many of you are represented by Congressman Edwards, who listened to this program and to this station. I think it's interesting, your background. I mean, I remember when you first ran against Albert Wynn, you talked about your growing up as the daughter of a military family, a military brat, and how that kind of shaped your life.
Right, I did. I mean, it really is, my upbringing, growing up in a military family all around the country and all around the world, really helped frame who I am and how I think about things. And especially my perspective on international relations, as well as the wonderful diversity that we have, not just in Maryland, but across our country.
I wonder, one of the things you ran on in the very first summer against Albert Wynn, and also in this last race against him, you talked a great deal about the Iraq War. And I wonder now, as a new young congressional representative, what your thoughts are about where that conversation is going on in Congress, and where you think both candidates for president, Mr. Obama, Senator Obama, and Senator McCain, are taking us in that conversation about the war, and whether you're actually satisfied with either man's position on where we should go with the Iraq War.
Well, Iraq still does weigh quite heavily, although, as you can see from, the current headlines, the situation and state of our economy has really taken the front seat.
Right.
But it's not disconnected to our involvement in Iraq. I mean, I think part of the reason that we're in our present economic circumstances has to do with, the amount of money that we're spending in Iraq that we don't have here to spend on domestic priorities, and, of course, is deeply related to the energy crisis that we face.
And let's talk about that a minute. I mean, one of the issues that we're going to be facing, of course, is the question of the housing crisis. The housing crisis is something that affects your congressional district probably more than most any other in the country. The amount of foreclosures, and you spent a great deal of time talking about that. And I wonder, again, I mean, you're new at Congress, and Congress is about compromise and everyone always getting their way and coming to some solution that can satisfy this broad spectrum of politics and the American people. But you've been pretty passionate about what we need to do about the banking industry and regulation. And I wonder about your conversations in Congress around that issue and where you plan to take that fight.
Well, and I think already I've had the ability in this conversation around particularly how we deal with the current crisis of foreclosure and the banking industry, and I've already weighed in on those conversations, and I was fortunate to be part of a House that passed perhaps the most sweeping piece of legislation that we've had really in decades to both re-regulate the banking industry, but also to give some relief to states and to homeowners in this current foreclosure crisis. And I'll just give you an example. When the bill was being considered, someone said, well, we're going to create a fund that's going to allow states to buy up, states and local jurisdictions to buy up properties and turn them into affordable housing, properties that have been foreclosed on. And they were really just concentrated on cities. And I said, whoa, wait a second here. A state like Maryland, yes, we have some cities, but we are really organized by county, and so we need to make sure that resources go to counties to enable them to participate in this program. And then, of course, the program was created, and it was expansive to include jurisdictions like counties and cities and states in that foreclosure bill. And that was just from a conversation, an offline conversation, about, you know, how we needed to make sure that a fund was put together that really would bring real relief to Marylanders.
Now, I wonder, Congressman Edwards, if you're kind of satisfied with the moves by the United States Congress, Senate, and the House when it comes to doing something about the housing crisis. We've seen huge bailouts of places like Bear Stearns, and a lot of people are arguing that the bailouts of bailouts or the help being given to regular citizens don't amount to very much, and that they're really not doing a great deal to help the average citizen deal with the crisis that they face in terms of keeping their homes. And I wonder what you think needs to be done if you are, again, not completely satisfied with the direction Congress is going.
Well, I do think that the American Housing Rescue and Foreclosure Prevention Act that we passed is a good step forward to try to stabilize the housing market. I mean, and so this idea of jurisdictions being able to purchase homes that are foreclosed on and then turn them into affordable housing in a community like mine, for example, that's really important because we can't just have a whole bunch of homes sitting empty when people are in need of homes. Also expanding the capacity of the FHA to do more lending in all of our communities is really an important measure. In a jurisdiction like the metropolitan areas, like the Washington metropolitan area, Prince George's and Montgomery County, but also in cities like Baltimore County, where the median price of homes is actually much higher than what FHA offers its mortgage limit. Well, we've extended the mortgage limits up to $725,000, which will enable people to buy a home at a reasonable interest rate and a long-term term loan, and one that's not one of these funny loan products that's been put on the market that's really put consumers in quite a bind. And we regulate the industry. Do we need to do more? Absolutely. I'm one of those who really believes that we've got to enable the bankruptcy courts, for example, to be able to renegotiate home mortgages in the context of bankruptcy. I think that that's the next thing that we have to do, because that will, again, keep some of our most vulnerable people in their homes. And we have to create affordable housing so that folks aren't buying more house than they can really afford.
Do you think that in Congress that and in our country has to kind of revisit all of the laws we passed back in the 1990s when they repealed the New Deal Glass-Steagall Act, which prevented commercial banks from putting their business together with investment banking in the 1990s, when the deregulation of banks allowed for them to lower their rates, and that kind of helped kill the savings and loan industry, that some people think all that is kind of a precursor to what caused this housing crisis that we're facing now with banks. And how do you revisit that? I mean, how do you build a coalition in Congress to create a conversation so that America takes notice of what might have happened to us?
Well, let's look at what we are doing. I mean, I think many of us recognize, and certainly many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle recognize, that we let the banking and the credit card industry go way overboard, and it's time to rein that in. I think the Housing Rescue and Foreclosure Act that we passed, you know, takes another step to regulating those industries. But many of us recognize that it's time to regulate. It's time to put some boundaries on the kinds of loan products, for example, no interest, low interest, no down payments, faking out the mortgage lenders by creating, income that didn't exist. These kind of things, practices really should never have happened in this market, and we're going to get a handle on that. But I think that you're right. In so many areas, we're actually recognizing that it's time to get back to some form of regulation of some of these industries, whether we're talking about the banks and the credit card industry or the telecommunications industry, or look at what we've done on energy. I mean, we've said in the commodities futures trading market, look, we're going to cut down on the speculation, the undue speculation in the energy markets that's actually sending our prices up, and merely even, sort of pushing that. You see what's happened over the last couple of weeks with oil prices. There's a healthy amount of speculation that needs to be in that market, but we have to, impose regulations that don't allow for the unhealthy speculation that drives prices up.
We're talking with Maryland's newest congressional representative, Donna Edwards, who represents the 4th District, Prince George's County, and its environs, and she stands for election in the general election in November. You can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, or you can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com and join in this conversation with our newest congressional representative, 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jerry.
Let me say this to you, Congresswoman, because you're new, and certainly none of these comments apply to you, hopefully yet. But once you unleash the lack of regulation of investment banks, and once you let a war start, it's almost impossible to end that mess without terrible effects on the economy, on America's security. And one of the things that is happening now, I heard an oil trader this morning on NPR explain what you've said, there is a role for healthy speculation. What that is a bromide. What is, according to this commentator who spent a lifetime in the oil industry, there people used to deal in trading with what they called wet barrels, actual barrels of oil. Now they deal in what is called paper barrels. These are non-existent barrels on which the price of oil is based worldwide. Congress needs to get in early on those matters. Barney Frank is one of the few people in all of the Congress, Democrats as well as Republicans, who let this mortgage crisis happen, the subprime lending crisis.
All right, but let me let Donna respond, because we only have a few more minutes with her before she has to go, and we move on, actually, to that very topic that you raised, Jerry. Congressman Edwards?
Well, Jerry, I share your passion, frankly, because I do think that, once things go down a line, it is really difficult to pull them back. But what we can see, particularly as it relates to energy, as it relates to the banking industry and foreclosures, is that if we don't start to rein them in, we have no hope of recovery. And so, with the oil speculation, I think some of the things that we've tried to do, even in these last days in the Congress before we went on recess, was really to try to pull out the part of the speculation that was just about investors, driving up the markets and then selling off the next day. These are not people who are really in the oil market. These are, folks who are just trying to, sort of make a dollar and a dime, and more than that, millions really, in trading off these products. And so we're trying to pull those folks out. And I think we've got to do something really serious on energy. I mean, part of the reason that the oil markets have been driven the way they are is because we haven't made the investments we need to make in alternatives, because, it may not be now, but eventually we actually are going to run out of oil, and we've got to have a game plan for that. And that game plan has to be investments in alternatives. And I will say this to the oil companies. They complain about not having new refineries, but they've made billions of dollars. invest in a new refinery. The oil companies, you know, complain about not being able to drill. We've got 68 million acres of their leases that they are holding on land they could drill on. Do that. And so, you know, all of us have to play a role, and the role for government and the role for Congress is to create a set of rules that's a level playing field, not just for the industry, but also for the American people.
And Congressman Edwards, before we go to break, I want to thank you for actually helping lead into our next segment, which is about the oil in our economy. So I appreciate that. But very quickly, in the last minute and a half we have here, I asked you earlier about the Iraq war and whether you were satisfied with either Senator McCain or Senator Obama's approach to ending the war, getting out of Iraq. Are you?
Well, I'm on the side of, one, obviously we never should have been there, but we've got to get out responsibly. And I think that we have to have a plan for doing that. And I tend more to agree with Senator Obama's approach of, you know, trying to establish some sort of time frame, and also what the Iraqis themselves have said about setting that now it's the time to set a time frame for the, you know, extreme reduction of troops of American forces in Iraq. And I agree with that, but you can't, you know, get it done until you start it. And so I want to begin that now. And so I'm fully supportive of the Iraqi government's approach to this and the need to draw down troops. And also to restore our place in the world so that, you know, we don't run into this, you know, this circumstance again, engage in diplomacy.
Thank you so much for joining us, Congressman Edwards, and we will see you in Denver. We'll all be out there together, and thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Take care. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Bye, Mark.
We've been talking with Congressman Donna Edwards and Congresswoman, and when we come back, we're joined by Bob Carpenter and Tyson Slocum to debate out oil, our economy, and your wallet. So stay with us and join us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The number is the same here, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, or you can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And those who are just tuning into this show for the first time, that's Steiner, steiner@gmail.com. And you can join us with your questions by email or by phone. We're going to look at oil and our economy. We just finished talking with Congresswoman Donna Edwards. The last thing she said was that the oil companies have 68 million acres of land here that they have yet to tap. So why do they want to tap new things? We have to do things in a different way. Is that the case? The price of oil dropped through a three-month low, as was reported in today's New York Times and Wall Street Journal. But it has risen 65% in the last year. Home heating oil is up $1 a gallon. Much of what we buy has gone up. Much of everything we eat and have our stuff packaged in is oil based. We have a carbon based economy. So the prices are going to stay up. The airline industry and the auto industry are still in deep flux and in great danger. The people say the housing market has not bottomed out. Some people are blaming the speculators, as the reason prices have gone up. Is that the case? Do we have to start new drilling? We have two men here to join us today to talk about all that and more with your input at 410-319-8888. We have very different ideas about where we should go. We're joined in studio by Dr. Bob Carpenter, and Bob Carpenter is professor of economics at UMBC here outside of Baltimore, and Tyson Slocum, who is energy policy director for Public Citizen, who joins us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. And Bob Carpenter and Tyson Slocum, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Tyson, good to hear from you again.
And, great to be here.
Bob, good to have you again in the studio, our new studios.
It's good to be here.
On the new Mark Steiner Show here at our new home here, WEAA. So, the question I have is let's start with this. People are decrying, and Tyson, you've done it recently in your articles and in congressional testimony you gave, of Exxon making high profits while the price of oil is high and the stock market in a huge fluctuation. Let's start there. I mean, what's wrong with Exxon making high profits?
Well, there's nothing wrong with profits, but there is something wrong with windfall profits, and it's clear that the record income being enjoyed by the oil companies are coming at the expense of greater economic growth in the United States. So what's good for large oil companies is not necessarily good for the rest of the economy. And it would be one thing if they're plowing those record earnings back into things that are going to help end America's oil addiction. As President Bush himself said, America is addicted to oil, and that addiction carries huge national security and economic costs. Not just addiction to foreign oil, but addiction to oil, period. That's from President Bush himself. And the problem that I see when I look at ExxonMobil's balance sheets is that far and away the largest expenditure of the company is on stock repurchase programs. Since 2005, Exxon has spent more than $95 billion buying back stock. Now, that's in addition to the more than $150 billion in profits that the company has posted. That is a huge misallocation of capital, a transfer of wealth, if you will, from consumers to shareholders. And that money is not being adequately reinvested into the huge energy infrastructure needs that Al Gore and almost every leading policymaker says that America needs to invest in order to wean ourselves off of our addiction to oil. So if oil companies are not going to step up and make the right kinds of efficient investments that are needed, then the government's going to have to take the lead. And I think it's only fair to ask oil companies to pitch in by slightly increasing the rate of taxation, by either repealing subsidies or enacting a windfall profits tax, to provide the seed capital necessary to invest in renewable energy, energy efficiency, and mass transit. This, we're not talking about punishing oil companies. We're not talking about ending their ability to profit. We're talking about ending their windfall profits. And I think that that's a reasonable proposition to move forward on.
Bob Carpenter?
I have a different view on this. Windfall profit is just a different kind of profit, right? It's a sort of a short-run profit because of some sort of change in the market. In this case, you know, Exxon's making windfall profits because, you know, the price of oil has increased 65% over the last 52 weeks. In some ways, you know, the high profits and the high price of oil is good for the sorts of things that
Tyson Slocum.
Mr. Slocum was talking about, because these high prices are actually the thing that sort of stimulate energy conservation, right? I mean, and we're seeing this sort of thing and sort of trying to wean ourselves from oil in the markets right now. You know, the number of miles that Americans have driven, I think, has fallen something like 4% because of the high price of oil. And it looks like we're changing the product mix of automobiles because of the high price of oil. A lot of Exxon's profits have been driven by production and development. And with this high price comes incentives for them to develop not only their existing oil-producing properties, but it also gives other people outside of Exxon the incentive to develop more energy-efficient technology.
Well, Tyson, I want you to jump in here, but let me give some focus to this, jumping back into this conversation, because I think that you two have raised some issues here, and we're talking with Tyson Slocum and Bob Carpenter about oil, our economy, our future, and your wallet, where America is going, and what is really happening, and is it wrong that oil companies make these high profits or not, and where do they stem from? And we want you to join us here at 410-319-8888 to weigh in on this conversation, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, and we'll take your questions either way they come. But what you raised, a couple of issues were raised here. I think they come to the heart of where America is angry and wrestling with itself about the facts. Let's talk about those. I mean, one, let's talk about these record earnings. I mean, some people argue, and Tyson, I know you're going to make this argument, so let me just lay it out so we can put it on the table now, that these record earnings by Exxon and all the other corporations, now there are fewer companies pumping oil than ever before because they bought one another out and they've become much larger corporations, ExxonMobil and all the rest. And that this is A, fueled by market manipulation and what some people argue are anti-competitive practices, and B, that there is some strange hanky-panky, for want of a better term at the moment, around speculators and hedge funds speculating on oil, driving the prices up, and that it'll come down to a level now, but it'll regain it. It'll happen again because of that. Is that what's causing it, or is it just supply and demand? How are these things into place? Tyson and then Bob.
I do think that supply and demand has clearly been a primary factor. I mean, the world is using a heck of a lot of oil. Professor Carpenter did rightly point out that Americans have driven 37 billion less miles this year compared to last. That's nearly a 4% drop. So Americans are responding to these high prices, painfully so. I mean, it's still creating a lot of hardship with working folks, but they are driving a little less. It's forced conservation, if you will. But other countries like China and India continue to use a lot. Some of the biggest gasoline consumption growth in the world is coming from OPEC member nations, particularly in the Persian Gulf, where increased gasoline consumption in Persian Gulf countries is reducing their ability to export oil to the rest of the world. And large productive fields are becoming fewer in number. So oil is becoming more difficult to find. But up until recently, you know, oil had doubled in price from a year ago. And I don't see any underlying supply-demand fundamentals that justified that huge price increase.
Well, before we turn to Bob Carpenter, I wish you could get for a moment just in a very kind of precise way specific about the allegations you have made in your writings and to Congress that these record earnings were fueled by market manipulation, anti-competitive practices, and the role you see hedge funds and other speculators playing in this. If you could lay that on the table, because I want Bob to be able to respond, because I think this is what people believe in America. A lot of, some people do, some people don't. And it goes to the heart of what's making people angry about the conversation about the prices of oil in our economy. I'd like to put those things on the table. Tyson, Bob.
Yeah, and in the year 2000, Congress deregulated the energy futures markets where the prices of oil and other energy products are set. And that deregulation has resulted in the vast majority of energy trades occurring completely outside the jurisdiction of federal regulators. So when you allow powerful entities like hedge funds, investment banks, and oil companies to trade oil outside of any sort of regulatory oversight of the United States federal government, you're going to open the door pretty darn wide to anti-competitive practices. 'Cause with no cop on the beat, you have a lot of incentive. And I think the role of speculation is clearly evident in the recent drop in oil from a high of around $145 a barrel down to around $120 a barrel. It all stems from the single bankruptcy of a major energy trader in Oklahoma called SEM Group on July 14th. That firm declared bankruptcy with over $2.5 billion in bad energy trades. They immediately had to liquidate those long positions, and upon liquidation, prices immediately dropped 14%. So the selling off of one speculator immediately dropped prices 14%. That had nothing to do with supply and demand. It had everything to do with a speculator trying to inflate prices. So it's clear that speculation played a role, and with just one firm exiting, prices dropped 14%.
Well, let me turn to Bob Carpenter. Do you agree with Tyson saying, and if not, I mean, the people argue that what this calls for is Congress passing laws that have greater regulation on calling for windfall profits tax for oil, greater regulation on speculation and those markets, and that clearly is where Tyson's leading with this conversation.
I'm going to try to give you a short answer. I really think the world market for petroleum, for oil, is just so big. I think it's very, very difficult. I would say almost impossible for it to be manipulated by a relatively small group of people. You know, actually, when I heard Tyson Colloquium start his answer, I was going to say, you know, we're really on the same page. I think there's some potential for speculative activities to have some impact on the way that prices have moved recently. I mean, the story is that sort of people were speculating in houses, and now that money's gone to commodities prices, oil being one of the commodities, and now they're retreating from that, and that's why oil's dropped, I think, 18% in the last couple of weeks. But the other story is that there's been a really big increase in demand, principally, from India and China. And that increase in demand has really outstripped the growth in production over time. And he mentioned some of that. I mean, you know, the oil fields in the Persian Gulf, a lot of them are very mature, and so it's getting more costly to extract oil out of that.
But before I want to move on with some things here. I want to get back to this, but let me open the phones here, and I want to encourage listeners to join us with their thoughts about oil in our economy and oil in our future, and what we should be doing as a nation, and what we should be doing to regulate or not have more regulations on oil and hedge funds and speculative financial industry. Your thoughts are at 410-319-8888, or any questions you have about this that both these men will answer from very different perspectives as we talk with Tyson Slocum and Bob Carpenter. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And Marie in Baltimore, you are on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Marie.
All of you. This is my first time to call you on this
station.
You and I have talked before. My question is, I keep hearing on other stations that we get most of our oil from Canada. Is that true or false?
That is that not true, Bob Carpenter? I think it is true.
I don't know. I don't know.
Tyson? Did we lose Tyson?
Let me just answer the question. I mean, oil trades on a world market, and so it, you know, in some sense, you know, it doesn't, you know, the price of a barrel of Canadian oil and the price of and the wellhead price of a barrel of Saudi Arabian oil and Texas oil are pretty much the same, right? I mean, you may have different transportation costs. So at some level, it doesn't you know because oil trades on a world market. If we all of a sudden say, well, we're going to stop buying oil from Iraq or Saudi Arabia or something like that, that's not going to have an effect on the overall price of oil, because other people will buy it from those states and we'll just end up buying more from Canada.
But Maria, I have heard a great deal that a huge portion of oil does come from Canada, and that's one of the issues that's causing a lot of serious conversations between the Canadian government and American government, because Canadians are angry that they feel like they're controlled by the American economy, not by their own, even though they supply a huge portion of their oil to America. So, and when Tyson comes back, we'll see what his thoughts are on that, but we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you
so much. 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And let's go to Mike in Ellicott City. You are on the air.
Good afternoon. Good morning. I'm sorry.
Good morning. Good morning.
I got it right eventually. But I just want to thank you. Well, I want to invoke a very famous philosopher to deal with this historic problem of the level of oil company profits. I know many of you have heard him. I have the advantage of growing up in New York City, so I know Yogi Berra, the philosopher, very well. And he said this is deja vu all over again. The complaints about level of oil company profits are virtually a constant in American public discussion. That's, of course they have huge profits. Of course they control the world oil supply. And if we don't deal with something fundamental, a qualitative change to solve this problem, what you see is what you get. Nationalization has got to be considered. And I just want to add, put it in the mix. People are going hungry because there's so-called speculation in oil supply. There's futures in corn and soybean. And people are going hungry, and there's this disparity between wealth and poverty. If we accept it, we have to accept the consequences and the kind of country we're becoming.
Thank you so much, Mike.
You're welcome.
I think any caller that starts by quoting Yogi Berra is going to have a good question. And I think that here's what I think about that. The oil companies provide a resource that is vital to the operation of a modern economy. It's not just gasoline for our cars. It's plastic. It's an input to fertilizer. These companies, because they supply a vital resource, sometimes when that resource is in relatively short supply because demand grows too fast compared to supply, prices are going to go up. They're going to make big profits. Okay. And what's going to happen is, oil is what we call a really inelastic good, which means that when the price rises, we can't adjust how much we buy in the short run because we drive minivans or sport utility vehicles, or we've got, we're just sort of set up to use relatively cheap oil. So when prices rise, there's going to be a lot of short-term pain. I know I feel it when I fill up my car, when I pay my electric bill. But over time, what we do is we adjust how much we use. You know, we trade in a sport utility vehicle and we buy a Honda Civic. We move closer to where we work. You know, we turn the thermostat down in the wintertime. You know, these high prices give us an incentive, right, to become more energy efficient as an economy. And it's not just at sort of the level of you and I sort of, you know, putting on a sweater in the winter. You know, companies are going to become more fuel efficient. You know, car companies are going to change product mixes. Airline companies are going to buy more fuel efficient engines and sort of consolidate routes. And so these high prices sort of serve a purpose. Yes, they create short-term pain, but they give us an incentive to change the way that we use oil.
We're going to take a very short break here and come back in just a minute with our guest, Bob Carpenter, and hopefully Tyson Slocum will rejoin us. We had a phone break there, and we want you to join us at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on oil, our future, the economy, the environment, clean energy. Join us. Welcome back. The price of oil. Speculators on Wall Street. What's happening to our economy? How are they related? What's happening to your wallet? What do we have to look ahead to? Should we be drilling oil off the coast of America and in Anwar? What are your thoughts? 410-319-8888. As we talk with Dr. Robert Carpenter, Bob Carpenter is professor of economics at UMBC, and Tyson Slocum is energy policy director for Public Citizen. Tyson, glad you got back.
Absolutely.
I was worried over there for a minute. 410-319-8888. And before we go back to the phones here, and Matt's our next caller up, we're going to come to you. I wanted to come back to where we left off, Matt, and which is this question of speculation and the role of government, whether or not there has to be more regulation in the oil industry or not, on windfall profits, and this whole question about the role of the speculative industry in investments and what the response should be. And I think this again goes to the heart of this presidential debate as well as to how to deal with the future of America. So what are your thoughts, Bob Carpenter and Tyson Slocum?
I just wanted to talk a little bit more about speculation. I mean, a lot of the time when people talk about problems with speculators, they're talking about futures markets, right?
And hedge funds and the like.
Hedge funds. And they're buying, you know, energy on the futures market. And that's, you know, a lot of times what the Wall Street Journal emphasizes when they talk about speculative activity. And in case people don't know what a futures contract is, it's basically it's an agreement that we make today to buy oil for a specified quantity for a specified price at some point in the future. So you and I say, well, I'll buy 1,000 barrels of oil for $145 a barrel in 6 weeks. Okay? And the thing is that, you know, speculators can't just drive up the price all by themselves, because there are sort of really powerful countervailing forces. If you and I sort of conspire together to drive up the price of oil on the futures market beyond its fundamental values, there's going to be some other smart speculator or some other smart hedge fund who's going to say, look, you know, these guys have driven up the futures price of oil. What we're going to do is, you know, we're going to take an opposite position and drive that price back down towards fundamentals. And so the speculators could end up taking a bath because of the actions of other people. The main point is you just can't get futures prices away from their fundamental levels. Now, the other thing I was going to say is there's been this 20% decline in the price of oil relatively recently. There's two explanations for that. One is that speculators have left the market. And okay, the other one is this high price of oil has a pretty big potential negative effect on economic growth. And the expectation that there's going to be sort of a global slowdown in growth or a global recession has reduced the price of oil. And it's really hard to figure out which one of those two things is driving it.
Tyson, is it hard for you to figure that out?
Well, I mean, the fact is that when oil speculators chase the price of oil up, there's always a lot more room to go up than down. And so there's a lot of incentive for speculators to push the price up and make more money rather than push it down. And I think a clear example of that is Goldman Sachs, which is a huge global commodities trader. And they've got analysts who consistently come out with reports saying the price of oil will get to $200 a barrel. And what Congress needs to look into is this clear conflict of interest where the analysts at giant speculative firms put out research reports claiming to be independent, when really what they're doing is setting the new ceiling. They're announcing to their fellow speculators, here is the new ceiling target to shoot for. And I think that there is a lot of collusion. And when you see rogue traders, much smaller traders, like SEM Group in Oklahoma, that end up going bankrupt, or Amerant, the natural gas hedge fund 2 years ago, these are firms that bucked the trend. I think that there is more of a tendency among giant, unregulated financial firms like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to collude in these markets rather than compete, because they all are getting fabulously rich. And it's coming at the expense of the U.S. economy. And I agree with Professor Carpenter that these recent high prices have prompted some efficiency improvements, but it's coming at enormous cost, and it is wildly inefficient to rely on market prices alone to change consumer and investor behavior. The fact is that consumers cannot do this alone. We need help, especially for those of us who are middle income or lower income who cannot afford many of the so-called green energy improvements. These people cannot afford to install solar panels on the roof. They may not even be able to afford to buy a new car, regardless of whether or not it's a hybrid or not. And so, local communities are actually cutting back on mass transit service, because just as it's more expensive for you and me to fill up our car with gas, it's more expensive for local governments to fill up public buses with diesel.
So
mass transit lines are being cut exactly the time that people need access to them.
I don't know about Bob Carpenter. I mean, how do you argue against what Tyson just said?
Well, I think that if you bought oil at $145 a barrel, now it's selling for $119 a barrel. And, I mean, you took a bath. If you were speculating on the price of oil rising from above $145 a barrel, you've just lost about 18%. The other thing, and I think this is really sort of the crux of where Mr. Slocum and I don't see eye to eye, is that I just think that there are way too many participants in global energy markets for them to collude successfully. I mean, to have successful collusion, you've got to have a group of people who sort of act in concert. And the more people you have, the more difficult that is.
Well, I want to go to the phones here, but what the relationship is between the shrinking control of the energy market in the world, not the expanding control of the energy market of the world, how that affects prices, and how that plays into speculation of where oil and other funds are going. There may not be a collusion, but there's certainly some kind of interaction, even on a larger social panorama. I mean, maybe the problem is people always think of conspiracy theories. Maybe it's not so much they're sitting around going, hello, I'm the president of Exxon, I'm the president of Bear Stearns, let's see what we can do to fix these prices of oil so we can all make a lot of money and screw the public. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about a larger social panorama that actually forces interaction on a macro level that actually does do what Tyson is saying without it being a conspiracy.
No, I understand. Just let me say this. I mean, you know, when we talk about sort of trade in the futures market, because that's where everybody's talking about the speculation, right, futures contracts for oil. I mean, you have to remember that in futures markets, it's not just speculative activity. That's not their only purpose. It's probably not even the main purpose. The other reason that people use futures markets are to hedge. So when a company pays $145 a barrel for futures contracts, they're trying to lock in their energy prices. Something like Constellation Energy might do that.
No, I understand that, but what I'm trying to talk about is this larger sense where things are in the world, where money is in fewer and fewer hands, corporate control is in fewer and fewer hands, and it's not necessarily a collusion like you and I and Tyson sitting here making a decision about the world, but those forces collude on their own in a macro sense. Tyson?
Right. I mean, you do have a huge consolidation, and it's with national oil companies like those that are part of OPEC, large corporate conglomerates which responded to low oil prices and relatively weak earnings in the 1990s by aggressively engaging in mergers and acquisitions to vastly increase the level of consolidation, particularly in the downstream market in the refining sector, which has been extremely important. And then the total lack of effective regulation over the futures markets, which has empowered large financial firms like investment banks and hedge funds to engage in what I would call harmful levels of speculation. There are reasonable limits and uses for speculation. I'm not talking about ending
right.
that. Well, I'm talking about clamping down on the unreasonable, harmful levels of speculation, and you address that by re-regulating these energy trading markets. And look, there's manipulation going on even in the regulated exchanges.
Well, Tyson, I'll interrupt because of the time we have here. We have a lot of people calling in as we talk with Tyson Slocum and Bob Carpenter about our energy future and the economy. And let's go to our callers and see what they're thinking at 410-319-8888. And Matt in Baltimore, you've been holding on a while. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Matt.
My question is, traditionally, the price of oil has been pegged to the dollar. And with the devaluation of our currency, how does that affect these huge profits that the oil companies receive? It just seems like, since the dollar's going down, they need to make more of them to make up for what they have traditionally been getting in return. Thank you.
That's an interesting point. Let me start with Bob Carpenter. That has to play a role in the price of oil.
Absolutely. I agree. What was it, Matt?
Matt.
He's got it dead right. A lot of the OPEC states price oil in dollars. When the dollar falls, that means we've got to give more dollars to get a barrel of oil. So that is one factor that's had an impact on the price of oil.
Among many factors.
Among many.
Any quick thoughts on that, Tyson, before we go to our next caller?
Yeah, there's no question that there's a relationship between the eroding dollar and the rise in crude oil, and we have urged Congress to take a look at the role that speculators like Goldman Sachs play in speculating in both currency markets and oil markets simultaneously, and whether or not these giant speculators have their fingers on the scale and are simultaneously making large bets bearish against the dollar, pushing it down, while making bullish bets on oil, pushing it up. And I think the Congress ought to investigate how much of that is occurring and what role, if any, that plays in eroding the value of the dollar while increasing the price of oil.
Let me return to the phones here at 410-319-8888. And Thorsey in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Thorsey, you there? Did we lose Thorsey? Thorsey,
yes,
you there? Hi, you're on the air.
Okay, it seemed like only yesterday that the population of the United States was about 250 million dollars. I mean, 250
people.
Million people.
Right.
And today it's about 300 million. And in about 10 or 20 years, it'll be 450 million. And what that means here in Baltimore, for every two cars on the road, there'll be three, which would mean there'll be a tremendous need for oil, which should shoot the price up even higher. And my question is, nobody wants to talk about volunteer, and I repeat, voluntary population control. So, and finally, the thing is that here in the state of Maryland and the city of Baltimore, the majority of the people who suck up the tax dollars are the poor people who need services. And if you would just touch base on that, I would appreciate it very much.
Well, I'll tell you what, George, I think that's a topic actually for another day, but that day is coming. I want to focus on oil right now, but let me just...
Well, I am focusing on oil, and as the population increases, there's going to be a tremendous need for oil.
I think population is a huge issue, and what I'm about to say to you is that when we go daily on September the 8th at 5 o'clock in the afternoon here on WEAA, one of the first programs we're going to do, at the behest of one of my old friends and mentors, Howard Bluth, is a serious discussion on population and how that affects our world. He's been sending me all kinds of stuff, and I've been reading a great deal that he's been sending me, and it's going to be a conversation, I think, that we're not having in America that we will have on the show. But it does affect. I mean, population, clearly, the population of India and China, their thirst for oil is part of what's fueling this demand and the high prices.
Maybe the dominant part.
It isn't necessarily population growth. It is the way that we consume energy. And it's clear that we need to consume energy more wisely. And it doesn't matter if you have a billion people or a million people. If it matters what your energy consumption rates are per person. And that's where moving towards plug-in hybrid vehicles that using existing technology today will get 100 miles to the gallon. If you can have population growth and you can vastly reduce your oil consumption by using oil more efficiently. If we have the kind of solar revolution that this country needs, where every family and every building is generating electricity for free from the sun on their rooftop. That is going to have a huge benefit, not only for the climate, but for the pocketbooks of families and small businesses.
Bob Carpenter?
And I think really the differences that between Mr. Slocum and I on this are really that he wants more regulation to force people to do that, and I think people will do that as prices rise.
Bob Carpenter, professor of economics at UMBC, Tyson Slocum, energy policy director of Public Citizen. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure to have you both.
Great time, Mark. Thanks.
It's my pleasure.
Talk to you all very soon. The Mark Sanna Show is produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're assisted in studio today by our intern, Stavros Halkias. We're engineered today by Mike Nice. You can podcast this show and all of our other work, as well as read blog posts, articles, and let us know what you think at our website, www.centerforemergingmedia.org. And thank you all for calling in and writing in and being part of this show. For Public Radio 88.9 WEAA, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner, and take care.